we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense, in which we explore the deeper stories behind what we think are actual simple linear events. And what we're going to do is expand a story with Ken Mudd. This is Ken's first podcast. So this is, you know, it's a first for him. And I really want to hear what he's got to say. So Ken, tell people a little bit about yourself. What do you do? How did you get to where you are? You're sort of a very potted history. And where can people find you online and in the real world?
Okay, well, Gareth, thanks very much for having me. Like you say, it's first ever one. I'll see how I get on with it and see if it all comes through absolutely fine. I'm sure it will. Where do I start? Well, I've been in health and safety management for about 25 years now. It's not something I wanted to get into at all. I was working in operations at a local theme park, and I had a general aptitude for hazard spotting as it stands. And I was asked to say, well, obviously I didn't know what a risk assessment was or what health and safety was for that matter. But I was asked if I would consider going to do my first health and safety qualification, which I did, and I actually thoroughly enjoyed it. Not many people kind of say that sometimes, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was from there I knew I was going to have a career in health and safety. Over the next, 20-odd years, I was fortunate enough to practice health and safety in construction, manufacturing, tourism, education, logistics, retail, chemical. And at the same time, in those kind of 20 years, I went and did various other health and safety related qualifications up to my master's degree, which I finished in 2017. And after then, I decided I wanted to help more organizations with health and safety in work. And so I started my own business just 3 years ago called Your Safety. And we are based up in Yorkshire of the UK. And we really want to find the balance of health and safety in work. So I've been that person where tick lists, check boxes, audits, paperwork, bureaucracy. And a lot of the time it's a lot of safety work, but doesn't always help operations and the work people get done every day. So I wanted to try and strike that balance for organizations so they can find just the right amount of safety in work to prevent serious injuries, fatalities, life-changing events, those sort of things. And that's where I am.
Excellent. So you got a website and an email address?
Website is www.yoursafety.com, and that is YORSAFETY, from Yorkshire, of course. And you can find me at contact@yoursafety.com. You can look for me on LinkedIn under Ken Mudd. We also have a LinkedIn page for Your Safety as well, so you can find me on there.
Excellent. It's interesting that bit of, I have an aptitude for spotting hazards. And I would say that's an interesting bit about creativity. Am I able to look into the future about what might happen? I think that's a really interesting piece. And there was a blog I wrote or a post I put on LinkedIn recently of, you can't do an adequate risk assessment if you don't understand the hazards or the hazards that are there. And what came of that was I ended up stepping on a sea urchin, which was in the water that I didn't know about. And interestingly enough, most of the people at the same place we were at didn't know there were sea urchins on the beach as well, and in the water. So it's that bit of the ability to understand what that sort of threat and that harm, potential harm can be. Some's quite obvious and others not so. And actually, it's easy to spot
the hazards and the harm after the event, because it's there right in front of you. And what we're trying to do with this podcast is explore the context that can help us spot these things. So we start off with a podcast with a first story, a simple linear story. So Ken, tell us the story that you've got.
Okay. Well, it's quite a few years ago now. I was at an organization and we needed to do some quite significant electrical work. And that involved cutting 415 volt cables and rejoining them with what we call torpedo junction boxes, and then running new cable into a distribution board that's on site. And the cables were identified. There was six to do all in all. And unfortunately, on the time that the contract company that were employed to do it, they were cutting through the fourth one, and the gent who was doing it cut through a live cable, a live 415-volt cable, and suffered burns to his face, one side of his face, his forearm and his hands. And from there, it was obviously the kind of it's his fault for not identifying the cables. It was the supervisor's fault for not telling him the right cables. It was not following the whole cable run, as well as the fault of the organization, perhaps, to not do as much as they should have done for that particular activity to identify its cables. And that's kind of the easy story, if you like, for that. But there's so much more to that story than
yeah, as there always is. And you could sort of simplify that as, you know, poor leadership, poor management, poor supervision, should have paid more attention, should have done the job properly. There are lots of counterfactuals. And it would be interesting to see, given that event, the sort of language that would have been written in the investigation report, and I presume the HSE were involved as well, and the language that was used in that piece. And I can pretty much guarantee there would have been a whole scattering of counterfactuals. And what we've got to understand is actually that whole, how did it make sense for somebody to do what they did? And you sort of touched on this, that it's not just that unfortunate guy who basically cut through that cable while it's being live, and we could just sit there and go, should have paid more attention. We've got to understand a whole raft of things. So tell us the second story then, Ken. What's the background? And we'll probably disappear down some rabbit holes as you go through it.
Yep. Well, it's not often you can sometimes go back to a point in history and with these accident investigations and say that was the point that it kind of started. So this particular activity of cutting the cables was completed on a Sunday in December, the Sunday before Christmas in December, early in the morning, around about 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, some of that work had been planned to be done actually the following week, and it was brought forward and brought early. And that was because the contract company felt they could get ahead of program a little bit and do some work ahead of time, which meant that they could potentially sign off for Christmas, because that's what people do at Christmas, and be done with it. But unfortunately, there was other activities going on at the time, so that required power the Thursday and Friday to Saturday of that week. So scrap work was done Thursday of that week, and then the incident happened on the Sunday. The injured person actually wasn't involved in any of the prep work.
Okay.
At all. He just turned up on Sunday to do the job. So he was informed by...
And I'm guessing that's pretty normal for the sort of work we're talking about.
It is pretty normal. The supervisor was on the week previous, but the gent who unfortunately was injured, he'd only come in and done some work on the Sunday. And so he'd been in for about an hour or so on the Sunday before this incident happened. So we can talk about, should have had a really good job brief before they started, should have identified the cables nice and early and things like that. But when I said this incident, we know at what point it started. It actually started in April of that year.
Wow, okay.
So in the same area of where the substation is, there was a small fire inside one of the switch rooms in the bank, the draw bank that they use. The contactors were a bit defective. It's quite old legacy equipment. The contactors were defective. And that caused some small fire in that unit, which then resulted in power outage of the manufacturing facility. And manufacturing is one of those things where you can't just stop. You're always wanting to manufacture as much as you can. It's about getting the product made and sent to customers. But it caused about 5 days worth of downtime because there was a whole load of other electrical banks and drawers which were damaged, which meant cables had to be removed and then put into different places. There was a generator that was brought onto site to house other cables. And then it was deemed that, so this was early April, it was deemed that that whole section of the switch gear in the substation all needed to be replaced because it was all old. Mm-hmm. So that was identified in April. Now, the work that happened in December was as a result of that particular incident. So it was planned that the work would be replaced at the next available sort of shutdown, which involved getting a whole new substation, rerouting cables. And the contract company that was used, they quoted to run entire cables all the way from the substation all the way to the round to the point that it was needed. And it was deemed that it was quite expensive to do, to run those 450-volt cables around. So they opted to cut them and then rejoin new cables to the old cables to minimize cost and minimize any other longer-term issues for program. So there's quite a bit going on there. So that happened in April, and in May, all the cables that were identified to be cut were identified with the staff at the manufacturing facility and the contract company supervisor. The plan was to do the job in the summer months. Mm-hmm. However, that didn't transpire because over that summer period, there was also some requirement to do other works around the manufacturing facility, so it was put off. So then it was planned in for August. Mm-hmm. And
everybody's on holiday.
So, and on top of that, there was always planned shutdowns for a manufacturing facility to do maintenance and repair and things like that. And these typically were about 4 days in a month. And that was the time, because the power needed to be off, that was the time to do it. However, because of customer demand and productivity, those shutdowns were reduced to 2 days and not 4 days, which ultimately resulted in, well, it's impossible to do that job. We simply don't have time to do that. We'll do it at the next shutdown in September. No, 2 days instead of the four. All right, we'll go into October, November. No, 2 days instead of four. So it got pushed out all the way to December, where many manufacturing facilities have a huge, significant bit of time off.
Yeah. 2 weeks off.
Absolutely. But nobody really went back and identified the cables. Mm-hmm. They kind of knew. There was a bit of a walk around before the Sunday where this unfortunate incident happened. And it was kind of, it's that cable. Mm-hmm. Now, I wish I had a picture to show you, because it wasn't just like there were six cables there.
There were six in a whole raft of cables.
Because it was at the location of where all the electrics came into site and all the electrics went out of the site. There must have been 20, 30 cables all in all around that section. Now, obviously, one of the cables was live.
Yeah.
Because it's what happened.
So one of the things that I've come across in the past is where you've got a mixture of live and dead cables. So were some of them live, or was it only that one that was live?
No, there was some of them live. So the week before the work was to get done, the staff and the contract company went round and identified the cables. They traced them and they decided and agreed what needed to be locked off and isolated. And that was agreed. And so the supervisor, who was also on the job for the contract company, he wasn't involved in running in the new cables the week previously.
Okay.
Because that was subcontracted out to yet another company to run the cables in. So he wasn't sure exactly which ones there were. So there's quite a few assumptions made throughout all of that, which does happen. And the supervisor was relying on the contracts manager who identified the cables originally in May of what needs to be cut. There was no paint, no drawn markings. There was no kind of clear identification of which cables needed to be cut.
Yeah.
So they were really relying a lot on hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that meant some cables were live, of course, some cables were live. And some of the context around that, because one of the things that was asked was, and it's a genuine question, why wasn't all of the power cut to the site? And that just that would have alleviated that kind of, well, if you would have done that, then that wouldn't have happened. Well, okay,
that's
fine. What was part of that additional story is other work was getting done on the site. And there was a new piece of equipment that went in during that period, which is due for commissioning.
And they needed power for it.
And you've got this. It's almost like you know what was happening.
It's the reality of work where we've got conflicting goals. So in one space, you've got to have a totally isolated situation. So we remove all the power from it. But you sit there and go, this isn't just a single task. There are other things that happen. And so, in terms of maximizing productivity and delivery, you reduce the harm to what you think is that acceptable level. And that might mean that you've got stuff running live, and it might mean that, you've isolated the rest of the stuff. And that poses issues, as we'll probably get onto. And I don't know what the background is. And one of the things that I have picked up, being that sort of self-aware piece, I'm going, I'm already asking my questions in my head, and I'm not verbalizing those, is, why wasn't this done? Why wasn't this done? Why wasn't this done? So even though I want to explore those stories, I'm already trying to piece together an incomplete story with my previous experience. So Ken, please carry on.
No, that's fine. All correct points as well, Gareth. Yes, you're right. Commissioning needed to be done. Those conflicting goals were, it's absolutely right. The commissioning of that before the end of the year, ready to start in the new calendar year, meant cost saving and potential profit, more profit for the business. So it was kind of a balance, and you had to juggle these things to do that. It was unfortunate that the cable that was cut was the cable that was to the compressor for the site. And it's a huge, huge site. And they needed the air, of course, for the commissioning. And the gent who had successfully cut through three cables without any issue whatsoever, there was only three more to do, started cutting the fourth one. And unfortunately, something had happened. Now, some of the other reason why they couldn't do it earlier in the week or on the Saturday was the contract company were having their own Christmas party on the Friday night.
Okay.
So people would certainly not be in any state on Saturday to do
anything. That's good risk, man. From their point of view of sitting there going, there's no point in putting people in, asking you not to drink on your Christmas party when you're working tomorrow. Well, actually, it's removed the hazard. And move it to Sunday. So that's a sound decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when the gents came in on the Sunday morning, there was a bit of, right, we have a risk assessment method statement to do the work. Although the company couldn't put their hands on it at the time to do that work. Permit to Work was written, and people went to sign onto that and go and do that. There was minimal kind of debrief, minimal brief about what the job was going to be doing, or what people were doing, and perhaps further confirmation. So in my world, I would talk about critical risk and say it's absolutely imperative that we get this absolutely right, even if we have to take extra time and run all those cables, and there's meters and meters and meters of these cables. And there was a degree of, well, you know the job, you've been here before, you've done lots of work before, you know what you're doing, just get cracked on and get it done. One of the reasons why the gent injured his face was because he was talking to his pal who was further down. So he was injured this side of face. And without getting into what they were talking about, they could be talking about anything. But the gent who was working with him was also making assumptions about the right cables because they weren't clearly identified and clearly marked. So there was a lot of assumption, a lot of, it was their fault, it was their fault, it was their fault, it was their fault, which just tends to happen. There was a lot more context and a lot more circumstance that led to that particular incident.
So as a sort of naive person, not knowing much about this sort of stuff, but having been involved in some events where they're using sort of cable tracers or live cable detectors, it's interesting. So the first three, did they use any form of live cable detection process? Or because what I'm getting to is most, I'm going to say sweeping generalization, lots of accidents happen as deviations from normal rather than deviation from the rules. Rules and normal might be the same, but often they're not. So what would be a safe process that would done, and then understand what was different in this situation?
I believe from memory, and I'm not any kind of electrical expert whatsoever, the cables was of such size and they were armoured that the equipment to test live cables simply wasn't there in that sense.
Okay.
So the practical solution, whilst time consuming, would be to almost put your hands on the cables and follow it all the way down to the point there and to the other end to make sure there's no, they're not connected, the power's dead, and so on. That for six cables,
that's a long time. What I was thinking of is where basically you get the electrical field generated by the cable, but if the cable's armored, then that detection mechanism doesn't work. In that sense. So, and is it normal, and I'm guessing not, to have flash protection or burn protection when dealing with this sort of situation? I don't know what the environment's like and whether or not that is the norm. I've seen stuff where the guys are doing high voltage, absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, for 415's not high voltage.
No, it's not. And all the cable runs and all the cables associated with all the equipment were all on the outside of the building. Nothing on the inside, they're all outside. They were all at a height, so there was some stairs to go up to a platform for them to work on. It wasn't temporary, it was permanent, so you can go and do that at that location. It was safe in that sense. The tools they were using, thankfully, it was a very, very good high-spec tool, and it was a battery-operated pincer, and I forget the name of it. So usually people would use a grinder to cut cables.
Wow, yeah.
With a cutting disc, but it sometimes can take time, the sparks and all that kind of other risk that goes with it. But this tool was just a big hydraulic pincer, and it just almost pinches the...
I think it's fine when you cut stands. Yeah. Door pillars and things.
That's it. So it was a very, very good tool, but at the same time, it was also had a lot of safety protection in it for that individual. And that's why it was kind of burns from heat rather than electrocution.
That's interesting. There was another bit, that, or two other bits I picked up, and one of them relates to some training I delivered a couple of weeks ago, where we were talking about business risk and safety risk, and where organizations take risk to achieve productivity, or, you know, to make themselves more successful. And that might be ahead of schedule, it might be profit, it might be about reducing the manpower and the resource you've got. And one of the bits that I tried to get across to the two organizations we're working with was that risk is often seen as a negative, but there is always a positive side to a risk. What's the gain that's happening from this? And understanding the loss and gain at the business level and the loss and the gain at the individual level, and understanding that's why people do the work they do. And when we're in losing situations, so we're behind schedule or we're behind in terms of money, or we've got extra work to do that we weren't expecting, which means that we're going to take longer, we will take greater risks. We will look to be more confident and more successful than we would normally do so. So in this case here, we've got, you know, a business risk that says we've got to get stuff back up and running by the start of the calendar year. We've got a finite time because we've got the close down. We've got to get that compressor commissioned in this period as well. So it's not just looking at the negative side of things when we run these investigations. We've got to look at what the business element is, the commercial element, the resource element. And anybody who's sort of seen stuff that I present, we talk about Rasmussen's trade-off between unacceptable performance on one side, and we've got money and we've got resources. And each time you cut resources or you cut money, you move the organization closer to the failure line. And you never know where the failure line is until you step over it. What we've got to do is create that bit that sits there, the thought bubble, that little voice that says, you know what? This is probably not what we want to be doing, which is exactly what they did on Saturday morning, where they said, you know what? We know the guy's going to probably be hungover because, and as a consequence, let's not put them in that situation.
Yeah.
Then it's that of how confident are we? And to your point about critical controls, here's the critical risk. It goes bang because the cable's still live. How do we control that energy? And if we can't use a sensor to find out because the field is protected because of the armoring, then what other ways can we do that? And if that is a manual trace that goes round and you basically sit there with a spray can and you spray can each cable that needs to be done, fine.
Yeah.
And it's understanding, because how long were they offline business-wise because of that then?
Earlier in the year, they were offline for because of the fire in the substation, which is the first thing. They were offline for 5 days.
This accident?
And this accident, because they were it was during a shutdown period at Christmas anyway, so there wasn't much of an issue in that sense. So back into the calendar year, I think there was only a couple of days from memory that impacted, because the work obviously still needed to be done. And we couldn't have it left in the state that it was left.
So it's then there's going to be a delay.
Yeah.
The other piece I've got on here was the permit to work, and discussions with a company earlier summer of last year. We're talking about permit to works for all sorts of different activities, and we're just saying, is the permit to work the paperwork, or is it to generate the conversation, to identify the hazards, identify the critical controls, and make sure those critical controls are in place? And what we found is, you know, yes, we'll do them, but do you have the conversation? No, because we've got the paperwork.
Yeah.
But the paperwork actually doesn't create safety in of itself. It's a facilitation and a marker for a conversation to sit there and say, can we confirm that those critical controls are in place?
Yeah, I agree. And I know in my time, when it comes to permit to work, and historically I've been in organizations where it became about liability management rather than safety in itself. So if any time a contractor was to be on site, regardless of what they were doing, they need a permit to work. And I would say, okay, so what sort of jobs would that include? And in the past, I've had people say, well, the window cleaner will come in and clean the windows with a pole at ground level. And I would say, there's no risk in that. Just have a conversation, a bit of induction, you know, talk through that. All the way through to a contract company who would come in and replace those kind of, you know, the mats you see at doorways, they get dirty and filthy.
All right. Yeah.
And I'd say, oh, come on, that's not it. And permit to work to me was always, if there's significant risk, you need to have this and have that conversation. That's why the briefing part and the learning afterwards, the debriefing afterwards, is so important. And I think my experience is when you have a permit to work system and you apply it to everything, it dilutes any of the other risk. So it becomes very much a just sign on the permit and we'll just get on and do the work.
Totally.
And it's all for a contract company who specialise in doing electrical work, that's bread and butter for them. They do it day in, day out. It's not a big, it's just normal work for them. Yeah. So there'll be a degree of, yeah, we've done cables all the time. It's all right. It's no problem.
Yeah. And how do you validate that this is the one? And it's that chronic unease that's needed to sit there and go, can I, with 100% certainty, confirm that that is A, the right cable, and B, it's dead?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, then and it's easy in this sort of, you know, podcast environment to say, don't progress with the work. But actually, it's also understanding all of the other pressures. So what was the learning that came out of this, if anything? I mean, I often talk about lessons identified, lessons learned. You know, the lessons that we identify from this that says, be more careful, pay more attention, make sure the cable's dead, make sure, you know, it's isolated, we've got the right cable. Those simple bits. But the real learning is you put something in place and you notice a change for whatever. So what learning, if any, came out of this?
Most of the learning was as a result of the investigation that took place. Now, there's a slight caveat in some respect, because I was leaving that organization 2 days after this event happened. So the amount of learning that I'm aware of is minimal, although I have looked back and I've seen what happened. There was deficiencies and system weaknesses, really, in how contractors were generally managed when you appoint them. There was system weaknesses, certainly in the permit to work system that they used. There was other system weaknesses in relation to, like lots of companies in my experience, they deal with a contract company, they'll ask them for risk assessments and method statements. A lot of them tend to be quite generic, with people just names changed out from where they're working. But rarely do we then assess the risk of what that contract company might be exposed to whilst they are working on our site or on our property. And so there was issues missing in there. And then when we did finally look at the risk assessment method statement, that kind of critical control that you mentioned, and that went to do with critical risk, it wasn't clear and obvious in the paperwork. It wasn't clear and obvious in the method statement. It's, we're going to cut these cables and it's going to be right. And there was some more learning in terms of where those significant risks are. And I was talking about high severity, low frequency. So it's just the kind of the one chance that it could totally go wrong. What have we got in place to fail safely? And so some of the learning was around that kind of level of risk, where historically the risk was not exclusively to this particular incident. The risk is avoid slip, trips, falls, cut fingers, you know, bad backs, all of which you want to avoid. But a lot of the time, they don't change people's lives if for the negative. And you kind of end up managing liability and managing numbers and managing metrics than you do about creating safety for the people who actually do the work.
It's that bit of how do you develop capacity? How do you look at the benefits without just focusing on the negatives and not just saying everybody's lucky? So how is it they manage to remain safe for most of the time? What is it that you could sort of bottle up and you sit there and go, how is it these guys know that this is the right thing to do? And it, yes, it can be about following the process, but the process is never complete. We as the humans complete that design to get the done. So what is it that people are able to pick up on and say, that's my critical backstop as an individual or a supervisor?
Yeah. I think a lot of it comes down to recognizing that we are all human and we all will make mistakes. So mm-hmm. having that kind of open discussion in an environment where you can bring things up without kind of judgment or people going, don't be daft, just get on with it. And, you know, you're a competent, trained person, just get on with it. I think it's really important that before jobs where there's significant risk, critical risk, that there's clearly time planned in making sure the equipment's right, making sure if you've got critical risk in place, that the controls are in place for that, that the people who are coming to do the job are fully converse with what they're going to be doing. And that sometimes takes time. You talked about the risk and reward. Even though that planning part of it might take an extra 10, 20, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever it might take, ahead of the time to put that time and resource in that point rather than running around afterwards is far more valuable. It's always difficult because lots of organizations, I think, would look at it and go, well, that might not happen and we could save that time if we just get on and do it. But it's always that kind of one bit. And if you can have a cross-functional group, just kind of have a psychologically safe environment where they can say, hang on, are they absolutely 100% dead? Even if we have to take our time to do it, can we double check? There was a lot of assumptions. There was a lot of relying on other people's knowledge. And I think if I had been the one cutting a cable, I'd want to know 100% that is.
Yeah. So there's a bit here on Wednesday with working with sort of high-end organization. They were talking about trend analysis. And I said, the problem is, they're low frequency. And so it's very difficult to spot the trend. What I said is you can look for conditions. So in your near misses, you're going to have conditions. And you can spot trend analysis on the conditions surrounding the event. So in that case, you know, on the Saturday, they managed that because they went, you know what? We know what the conditions are going to be like of people's heads. So we're going to push the work. But it's that bit that says, oh, well, we're always working under time pressure. Therefore, it's become normalized. As that's just how we do it. We have conversations with people because it's what we do. When you talk about the guy looking to the right-hand side, and it doesn't matter what they were talking about, you're right. Now, interestingly, had he been facing it, he'd get a full face rather than a side face. But in critical industries like the aviation space and healthcare, surgical theatres, they talk about sterile space. So a sterile cockpit, and where actually you talk about, right, this is critical, no conversations. And when I work in the diving space and I talk about people putting together their dive gear, especially stuff that's got failure modes that are hard to detect, I say to them, right, you've got to put, you know, if it comes to it, just leave me alone while I put this together. Now, if I'm on fire, come and put me out, but don't disturb me while I'm doing this critical activity. Once we've done that, then we can have a conversation. So I think in those situations, again, is identifying those conditions where distractions are critical negative outcomes. They're the error multipliers that are out there. And put that into the sort of the working ideas to sit there and go, how do we protect our people from not making mistakes or reduce the likelihood that those mistakes will be made? And if they are made, how do we trap them? And ultimately, that is the only way you can do it, is isolating those cables. You can't isolate the whole substation or the unit because there are other things. So we've now got to find a different way. So,
yeah.
Ken.
That's absolutely right. Thank you.
So the final piece of the podcast is a paper, a story, a video, a book, or something that, or multiple versions if you want, that has influenced your sort of thought process, how you look at the world now, or just generally a really interesting read or a watch for people that will help them grow and learn?
Wow. There's so many I could pick from. I think a lot of my view of the world and view how safety was changed probably during the research of my degree, where I read loads of papers, loads of books, as you do. One of the things that jumped out at me, probably that steered me a little bit, was Decker's Safety Differently book. However, I've read a lot more since then. And one book that's kind of popped into my mind is Beyond Blame by Dave
Zweibeck.
Thank you.
Yes.
Zweibeck.
Yeah.
Which is Learning from Failure and Success, which is a really good story in that book about how a competent IT guy was going about exactly what he would usually do in solving a problem and caused a bit more of a larger issue. I won't spoil it for anybody who wants to read it. But I found that really, really good. There are other things that I've enjoyed in
reading. It's not a very long read either. It's only about a 90-minute, 2-hour read. It's a good short book to get those points across in a punchy way.
It is, and it's good. And the theme of that book of learning from failure and success is really good, because you can go and find out where those conditions are, those deficiencies are, before something perhaps negative may happen, which is quite often what we don't do, because they're always there. Ultimately, they're always there. Other things I've enjoyed, I liked Craig Marriott's Challenging the Safety Quo. That's good. So
yeah, is your thesis available?
Well, I can send it to somebody if you want it. I don't know if
I can upload it. I mean, what was it on?
My thesis was on human error and one-to-one safety feedback conversations.
Cool. Right then, send it over. I'll upload it and it'll be in the show notes.
I will dig it out and I'll send it over. I did pretty well, so nobody's allowed to then say, oh, that's a load of rubbish.
It's all, so mine was all about storytelling to learn, the one at Lund. What are the barriers to storytelling following events? And yes, it was around about the diving space, but it's got loads of applicability everywhere. So it's all about contributing knowledge to the community and the skill of those practitioners out there is they take ideas, stories like this, and abstract it into their own space. One of the really powerful negative biases to learning is distancing through differencing. So I don't do electrical work, Ken. So what you've just told me adds no value to me at all. That would be the bit, and it's like, well, off we go. The same as Beyond Blame. You know, you read that and go, well, I'm not an IT person. I don't do server management. I don't do all of that stuff. But there are so many lessons that can be learned when you've got an open mind and you want to grow as a consequence. So send it over. I'll stick it in the show notes, and people can read all about your research and what you contributed to the industry.
No problem. I can do that.
Excellent. Ken, thank you very much for your time. Really enjoyed the conversations. And it's really interesting for me as well, where I'm analyzing my little thoughts going, da-da, da-da, da-da. Why haven't they done this? And, you know, the classic one was, why didn't they just use a detector? Well, if you've got an armored cable, you can't. So that's brilliant. Excellent. Thanks so much, Ken. Take care. And it'll be out soon.
Thank you very much.